From KRCB in Santa Rosa, it's Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour with Michelle Anna Jordan.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
In my kitchen, there's hard to be raining her do.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see? You start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? A little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a bigger pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. How are you doing this evening? If you are listening in real time, what a glorious day, eh? Really warm, really beautiful. A little troubling. If the rains are over, I don't know, I think it's a drought year myself, even though we had that little bit of rain recently. People are nervously staring at grapevines to check for signs of bud break. Would not necessarily be a good thing this early. Now, if you're a regular listener to Mouthful, you are probably aware that every now and then we take on serious issues rather than just delicious topics. And we've been lately off and on doing something that John Ash suggested I call Mouthful Salon, which has been a conversation, an intermittent conversation about who is food for? Who is good food for? Who is artisan food for? What's this whole deal of incredibly expensive, hand-tested, hand-raised delicacies? Who do those foods go for? Who is suffering? All that sort of thing. And in a way, I see tonight's show as dealing with that topic for the whole hour. I'm welcoming back Daniel Imhoff, who's been here twice before, right, Daniel?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'd really like to be here.
I'm so glad you could come back. You were here initially for Farming with the Wild, and then you came on with a book I really enjoy, Paper or Plastic, a question I've never been able to answer. And now we have Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to a Food and Farm Bill, the foreword by the now very well-known Michael Pollan. So congratulations on the new book.
Thank you very much.
And I know you've been working really hard on this for, what, about the last year?
Yeah. I became convinced that this was a really needed project back in the summer of 2005. And I was at a conference in Sacramento. It was kind of a teach-in on the farm bill. And they had just passed an energy bill and a transportation bill, and they were these huge spending expenditure programs for many, many years, taxpayer money going for what I just couldn't understand, given the scarcity of petroleum and global warming and all these different things that we were dealing with. It seemed just scandalous, really. And I became convinced that the Farm Bill is this engine that really drives our food and our farming system, but way beyond. It has many, many implications, really, that just unravel every day in our lives. And I know that the Farm Bill is definitely not top on most people's list to get informed about. I think it's pretty Well, I just think that there's a real fear factor of going in there and really learning about the Farm Bill. So I took about a year and tried to deconstruct it, demystify it, and really bring it down to basics, why everybody should really care and has a stake in the Farm Bill, in a good Farm Bill.
Now, when I hear the term Farm Bill, up until I knew about your book, and I consider myself relatively informed on these topics since I do make my living, for the most part, writing about, you know, food and related issues. To me, the Farm Bill, you say those words, and I think Washington, D.C., I think really far away from me, I think distant and not relevant to what I do in my day-to-day life and day-to-day work, which is go to farmers markets, support local, you know, vendors and farmers and, you know, people who do things close to home. And I know that that attitude is not correct. And that's one of the things I'm hoping you will do, is tell us why it matters to each of us, how it impacts local life.
Well, I mean, obviously, if you pay taxes and if you eat, if you have kids in any kind of a school, if you care about people who go to bed hungry, if you care about family farmers and actually the proliferation or maybe the suppression of farmers markets as a real true alternative to food, if you care about how our policies here in this country affect not only our family farmers here, but farmers in different countries, and you care about fair trade, all those things have to do with the Farm Bill.
So the Farm Bill is really a very big umbrella.
It's a huge umbrella. Uh-huh. They call it an omnibus bill. An omnibus just means that it's dealing with many, many different issues at the same time. It's evolved from the days of the Great Depression as a real emergency bailout for both seriously aggrieved farmers and disastrous situations on our farmland, but also the hungry. And today it's a $90 billion per year program. There are more than 10 different what they call titles. Each title is a certain kind of a program. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this $90 billion a year is a real engine that it basically shows, you know, what it makes farmers grow, what they're going to grow, where they're going to grow it, how much, what varieties, how our food tastes or doesn't taste.
So it actually establishes things that specific.
Oh, yeah. It makes direct incentives mm-hmm. for farmers to grow or not to grow
certain
crops.
And how does it
do that? Well, it goes all the way back to, the early days, when in the early days of farm bills, which started in 1933 under Franklin Roosevelt's administration. They basically picked targeted crops. And what's really interesting when you go back in the history, when they were having these farm disasters in the 30s, it wasn't because there were shortages of food. There were overproduction. We'd just been plowing up lands and busting sod in places that we never should have really done so. And for nearly two decades, you know, they were having these bumper crops, and then came the great drought and the Dust Bowl, and everything all just, you know, completely, the wheels came off of our agricultural system. At that time, I think they started out subsidizing, making payments and loans and other kinds of direct government funded programs to farmers for about 100 different crops. So, you know, when you think back of those days in the 30s and how diversified our farms were, mm-hmm. and they had little pastures and they had animals for their manure and they had, you know, all different kinds of crops. Well, today, our subsidies go for mainly five crops: corn, cotton, wheat, rice, and soybeans.
And so we pay subsidies to farmers to grow those things.
That's right. Some farmers receive direct payments. So mm-hmm. whether or not they grow anything at all because of their base history in farmland, in commodity farmland, goes way back to those days of the 30s. Some farmers get, you know, a payment for the land that they own. And then if they enter into these commodity programs, then they're eligible for other kinds of incentives. Uh-huh. And this basically encourages them to plant because they know that there's going to be no risk. Mm-hmm. No matter where the market price falls, the government's going to make it up because they set a certain target price. And what this really does then is encourages huge amounts of overproduction. That means the price is going to remain really low. And that's really good if you're, you know, Coca-Cola or you're ConAgra or you're Archer Daniels Midland or Cargill or someone who's buying those cheap commodities and then either trading them or turning them into some kind of product that you can then mark up at a really high markup.
Mm-hmm. Was that sort of subsidy situation, was that initially a good thing or was it just wrongheaded from the start?
Well, you know, I've looked at it for a long time, and I could probably go back and forth within any given hour. The man who started the farm programs was an incredibly smart, gifted person, Henry Wallace. And his father had been a Secretary of Agriculture. His grandfather had started this really famous Iowa farming magazine. They were really successful, but they really, really knew their stuff economically. What troubled Wallace in the beginning was that by the 30s, it was really obvious, I think, our economy had taken this change. And the industrial economy and the rural economy were no longer on the same path. So you couldn't get out of the ground, out of just natural resources, what you could in the industrial economy. And there mm-hmm. was this, what he called a disparity. And so he was trying to say, he was trying to do a number of things, but one of the things was, let's try to set prices on goods and pay farmers this, you know, just a little bit more so that there's more evenness between the urban and the rural economy, between the industrial and the agricultural economy. And but if you enter those programs, then you also have to commit to decreasing the amount of crops that you're producing. So in these early programs, you were only allowed to plant 75% of your historical base, and that had two very important reasons. One was for conservation. You know, our soil was blowing away. We totally overplowed everything, and let's just idle land and and keep it healthy. But the other thing was, if you didn't plant every single inch that you were allowed to plant, there would be less supply. Less supply mm-hmm. meant higher prices for the farmer. So that, you know, and I think that they tried their very, very best to make these things work.
Mm-hmm. And at what point, if this is a fair question, do you think it began to go wrong?
Well, it was definitely controversial from the very start. The government began to set prices for certain commodities, and as soon as they started to do it, the Supreme Court called it unconstitutional. You know, that the government could not get in there and interfere with markets. Another thing that they were doing, too, was they were buying lots of hogs and milk and storable commodities. Wallace had come across this concept called the ever-normal granary. It went back to Confucian times. It went back into Joseph and the Pharaoh. Joseph's job was to collect grain in times of surplus so that it could be given away in times of need. And so there was this real connection between, you know, what was grown on the farm and then the health of the people. And I think it was really, really difficult from the start. The USDA, you know, as soon as Wallace got in there, it just ballooned into a $1 billion department with 100,000 employees. And, you know, they were juggling all these things, and it was scaring many people that we were going to become a socialist country. We were going to get into this, you know, welfare system, and we would never get out of it. World War II kind of changed things, you know. I mean, we got on all systems alert, and we had full employment, and mm-hmm. I think things changed quite dramatically. And then probably in the 50s is when things began to go wrong. And to go wrong, I would say that this something got set in motion. They threw away the conservation aspects of the early days. Mm-hmm. And then the idea was, let's feed the world, let's plant fence row to fence row, let's just maximize our production. And then by the end of the 50s, I think there was this emerging order that America had, you know, the farms had to become big and they had to become industrialized and the little guy had to go. And the big, big grain interests really took control of the farm bill. And I don't think we've ever looked back from that, really, from those times of the 50s.
Okay, so coming up to the present, is that still the situation with the current farm bill, that it still benefits the really big producers of those commodities?
Oh, you know, it just has gone worse and worse.
Worse and worse.
You know, I mean, uh-huh. So, but there, it's not like, you know, the farm bill is not a fixed thing. So just because it, you know, it was done one way, what happens is it's now this $90 billion, let's just call it $100 billion program. I don't think that that's necessarily too much or too little. I just think really how you spend it should determine whether or not it's achieving its goals. But it gets authorized, actually reauthorized, because they reauthorize an old bill when mm-hmm. they do it. They
and
give
this happens
it a new
what, like
name.
Every 5 to 7 years or
it
something?
It happens every 5 years. Every 5 to 7 years. Uh-huh. And this happens to be one of those
years. So 2007 years, is a farm bill year.
It's a farm bill reauthorization year. It's going to be a big, big fight. And this is the reason I was working so fast and to get the book out this year, so people could really know about it and have and understand that they have so much at stake here. But what I was saying is, you know, there have been times when, if you call the farm bill a pie, when there have been these new wedges inserted into the pie and the pie got bigger, or maybe some of the money came from one part of the pie and it mm-hmm. went into a new wedge. One of the really important wedges to understand is in the 60s, President Kennedy had been on, tour on the campaign trail. And he was just astounded by poverty in rural America. And I think it got forgotten in the 50s that there were huge segments of the country that were, you know, they didn't have rural development and they were really, really impoverished and nutritionally really impoverished. So one of the first things he did was to reinstate the food stamp program. And it got caught on slowly. But as civil rights became important in the 60s, and as this idea of the Great Society came about, a lot of senators and House representatives began to see the Farm Bill as this important opportunity that they could expand the social safety net for poor Americans. Uh-huh. And so by the end of the 70s, by the 60s, the Farm Bill's nutrition title became bigger and bigger and bigger every year.
Mm-hmm. So, and by title, we should just say the bill, the omnibus bill,
yeah,
is divided into sections, and those sections are called titles.
That's right. That's okay. Right. So, and the two biggest sections, two biggest titles, programs, are nutrition and food programs. That's half of the bill.
Oh, really?
So from those uh-huh. origins of Kennedy, his first act of his administration, reinstating the food stamp program, that's now half of all farm bill spending.
Uh-huh.
And then the next biggest chunk are the commodity crops. And I just explained they were uh-huh. corn, cotton, wheat, rice, and soybeans. And they're about 35 to 40%. And there are a bunch of other titles, but, you know, the commodity groups somehow wrangle their way into getting most of that money. So uh-huh. it's really almost 50-50.
Really?
So what you've had, and there is a conservation title, there is mm-hmm. a conservation section, and that was another big, very important wedge that came in the 80s, in the middle 80s, when we were having these massive duck population crashes up in the Prairie Pothole region, and they reinstated in a big way the idling programs, the land conservation programs. But in general, what we've had really since about the late 60s was this: the commodity representatives in a very small number of states, with those urban hunger caucus representatives who care about hunger and nutrition, and they've made the farm bill happen for many, many decades. The interesting thing that is really coming to surface in this farm bill is that the health of the land, the health of our food, definitely has a direct bearing on our health.
Mm-hmm.
And we are extremely unhealthy, and it's completely linked to us increasingly subsidizing and focusing on this narrow group of crops that bring us high fructose corn syrup, really cheap animal feed grains for these big feedlots, really cheap oils and fats that go kind of indirectly but definitely right into the food pipeline,
mm-hmm.
and they're the cheapest things to buy. And if you we all know that obesity rates are just going through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
They're really, really high in certain poor areas of the country, and the poorest are the most hurt by these cheap food policies. And so now I believe that the Hunger and Nutrition Caucus is starting to wake up for that. Like, wow, we've made this deal for calories. You know, I mean, we hadn't had a minimum wage increase in 10 years.
Just seems astonishing.
Yeah, and if you look at the statistics, the number of people, of Americans using food stamps, choosing to take food stamps, has just been increasing exponentially by almost 5 million every few years for the last farm bill. So, you know, there's more and more hungry people all the time, but what they're getting is calories and not nutrition.
Not nutrition.
And so I think that's
a hugely important. Say that one more time. That's a really big distinction. Calories don't equal nutrition.
Not at all.
Yeah.
You know, as a matter of fact, calories, the way we're delivering them through these, you know, through directly or indirectly, however the farm bill and the food system works, they could be putting these folks to an early death,
mm-hmm.
you know, is what many nutrition advocates are now saying. I mean, it's like, you know, their only choice is to really go for these unhealthy foods, and also if you're poor, you're often very stressed and your eating habits reflect that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you're really susceptible to overweight and obesity and diabetes and heart disease and these other things that are absolutely 100% nutrition related.
Yeah. Okay, you are listening to Mouthful. We're going to take a little musical interlude and come back and talk about what it means that this year is a Farm Bill year. It's Mouthful. It's Michelle Jordan. It is KRCB Public Radio for Sonoma County. Thanks for tuning in. We are talking with Daniel Imhoff, author of Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to a Food and Farm Bill. So you were just saying off mic, Daniel, that the Farm Bill is, one way to look at it, is as a set of promises.
Yeah. So this year they're going to make some new promises, I hope, because anything could be better than the last set of promises. But there is something important to remember in the process, and it's not any different than many of the other bills that we live under and fund with our own taxpayer money. And that is, the Farm Bill is going to be this set of promises and programs and recommendations that the agriculture committees recommend for the next 5 years, and the president will hopefully sign into law, and hopefully it'll be a good bill for us.
And there's actually, it's not one committee, it's a lot of committees.
There's
that
two
work
committees,
on this.
Yeah. There's the
uh-huh.
Senate House and the Senate and the House Ag committees.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and also, the Bush administration has already put forth their program. So between now and August, when the Congress takes a recess, they're going to be hashing out what the actual bill that's going to go up for vote is going to be like.
Mm-hmm. And are there any, who are the leading Democrats working on this?
Thankfully, you know, with the changeover in November, Tom Harkin from Iowa is the head of the Senate Ag Committee. Yeah, and he is a very sympathetic voice to sustainable agriculture and other issues that the Farm Bill deals with. And then Colin Peterson from Minnesota is the head of the House Ag Committee. So these guys are going to make these promises, and we're going to get them. However, what the real power and the administration actually of execution of a farm bill comes every year in the appropriations process.
So the bill actually makes the promises, and then it's the budget and approval of the budget appropriations that actually delivers on the promise.
Absolutely, or does not deliver.
Right.
And I mean, the thing that that really has upset me, and I kind of came at this subject really naively with a beginner's mind, hey, I can figure it out. And as I learned, you know, some of the promises that got broken, it's, you know, normally what's happened over the last few decades is the promises that they gave to us for a better food and farming system, for better conservation, for better health and safety, those are the things that get cut. And the, you know, the record payouts to the commodity groups are the things that never get cut.
So I want to use an analogy, and I hope that this doesn't sidetrack us, but a friend just told me something that I think is a good analogy towards how this might work in someone's life. Says up in Oregon, a very large county had voted in public initiative money for a new library system, new building, and that sort of thing. And so they had this great, you know, they upgraded their library buildings, had this great new system, but it was almost zero. The money they got from the federal government went to most of, you know, paid most of the operating expenses, over 80%, I believe. And the Bush administration zeroed that out. That county now has closed all of their public libraries.
Yeah.
Even though the citizens voted, you know, paid for these buildings.
Yeah.
And created this great way to house the collection of books, there's no operating money, the doors are locked.
Yeah, now that's probably, you know, the Bush administration saying, well, that is not our problem, that is a state problem, or whatever. In the case of these farm bills, and it's true, I mean, the people who hold the purse strings hold the power.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few things that if you're tuning in to this year's Farm Bill, and I hope you do, because it isn't that hard to get into and to get your hands around these ideas, and I worked really hard in the book to make them easy for you. But there's two things that I want to talk about. One was the mandatory country of origin labeling laws. And that was put forth in 2002, and it's a very straightforward, if it's perishable and it comes from another country, they have to label it, right?
That doesn't seem like rocket science.
No, it was supposed to be done by 2004, by September in 2004. So they had a few years to work this program in. But, you know, the basically this huge coalition of big meat packers, big meat processors just started to put, you know, they inject, any given year, the ag business lobby is injecting $100 million into Washington to get their programs through or you know, not funded or funded.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the case of this COOL, country of origin labeling, they managed to thwart it. And so after a few, you know, after now it's been, you know, almost 5 years, only seafood is labeled. So vegetables aren't labeled, meats aren't labeled, poultry, dairy, all these perishable commodities, they don't have to tell you what the country of origin is. And you look into it, in your hamburger pack, you could have 20 different origins of meat in one pack of hamburger, and it doesn't have to show up on the package itself.
That's so creepy.
Now, you asked me about farmers markets,
mm-hmm.
right, and local food, and how does this farm bill have to do with local food? Well, I think that directly has to do with local food, because if you knew that it came from Mexico and Poland and Hungary and Czechoslovakia and Thailand and somewhere else, you would probably go for the California one, right?
Sure.
I mean, you'd go, gosh, I don't know if I want to go there. And increasingly, as you look at the statistics of how much food we export and how much food we import, we're almost importing as much as we're exporting. And the things that we are importing are these perishable commodities, are the, you know, the big meat guys, they're going overseas because there's less regulation, because the labor's cheaper. It's still cheap to ship this stuff around the world, and you don't have to label it. And so one of the things, if you care and you want to get involved, just remember COOL and how uncool it is that they took away the money for this program.
So it was
in the
actually
appropriations process.
So it was passed in the bill, but not
funded.
Not funded. So what are the chances of getting it funded in this next bill?
I hope it's 100%. I mean, this is criminal.
So this is the sort of thing you could write to Lynn Woolsey, Mike Thompson, that sort of thing, and say, I'm concerned about this issue. I want you to do everything possible to ensure.
Where my food's coming from.
Uh-huh.
You know, why can't I know? That, you know, I want to know, and I deserve to know.
That's it seems like a really basic human question, and that we should have the right to answer that. Where's the food we're eating from?
And they will tell us, big meat, you know, big food, they will tell us that, well, it's going to cost a lot of money to do this, to enforce this program. But I have to say, I think it's probably worth it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, especially in the long run, and especially because I think so many people would like local foods to not be precious, to not be so expensive, right? And I think once you realize the cost of this other food system, then those choices are going to come to light a lot more. And I'm not trying to say, you know, it's not a burden for someone to pay more for something, but we're not paying a lot now for food relative to our income. We probably pay less relative to our income than most other countries, but we're starting to pay this other great price, and I think there just has to be an adjustment.
You know, I always think, okay, big business doesn't want something to happen. They don't want food to be labeled, you know, as to its source. And they say they don't want to do it because it costs money to do it. And I think there's another reason. So what's the deeper motive that makes them not want to do it? Because they're just simply afraid that if people see that it's not from the United States, they'll choose something else, and they'll lose money? Or are there other reasons they don't want it to be labeled?
Well, I would say you can apply that logic to every single farm subsidy program.
Oh, okay.
You just figure, you know, like, what's it doing? Who's benefiting?
Yeah, who's benefiting?
Now, is it a failed policy, or is it an intentionally failed policy that somebody else wants to have happen, right? So if you are a conspiracy theorist, you can just go wild in the farm bill. But I really think with the country of origin labeling, it's really simple.
That's an easy one to focus on.
They are so paranoid that if you knew, you wouldn't buy it. And it's like the pivot point for the whole meat system. It starts with the cheap grain, the cheap corn, the cheap soybean, the cheap sorghum, whatever we can feed them. It's ubiquitous. It doesn't have to stay in this country. It goes all over the world to these massive, horrible gulags, you know, and that are getting bigger all the time. And then that meat's traveling all around, and we don't really know where it's coming from. And it ends up in our school lunches, and it ends up in, you know, the Safeway aisle. You know, it ends up throughout the food system.
Now, school lunches, they're under the umbrella of the Farm Bill, right?
$8 million per year goes for our school lunches. I think it's about $2.25 per lunch.
Uh-huh. Yeah, something
and,
like that.
And you know, some of it's direct money, but some of it's also food that gets distributed. You know, like, you know, some massive chicken farm has all sorts of thighs that no one around the world will buy, so they just
shove
it
in
the school kids. I mean, it's true, and you know, milk and all kinds of oils and, you know, things that that are made available.
So, are you feeling optimistic about what will happen this year?
I feel that there's no better time ever, you know, really, that we've had a number of things. Michael Pollan's book, you know, just this runaway big fat book,
big
actually.
Fat Omnivore's Dilemma.
Yeah, not
big fat bestseller.
Not so easy to read, and you know this really, but of course, extremely well written. And he wrote a great foreword to this book, but I think he really popularized the Farm Bill in the, you know, the first 100 pages on corn, just all the things that he has done with the cornification of America.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but there are lots of other forces. There are mm-hmm. people who care about fair trade, and the WTO ruled, the World Trade Organization ruled against our cotton subsidies that are basically illegal by the terms of trade, which we're, you know, we're contracted to deal with other countries, and we need to get rid of them, or else Brazil, who brought the case, can retaliate against us. So if you're interested in fair trade, the Farm Bill is an important issue to you. I've mentioned nutrition a number of times, but I don't think that we can talk about nutrition enough. Really, there's a really great study that came out of Minneapolis last year, and it looked at the costs of fresh fruits and vegetables and healthy foods versus the cost of soda and cheap industrial ingredients over mm-hmm. a 15-year period, and the fresh fruits and vegetables have gone up 40%, while the cost of those cheap industrial ingredients have gone down 25%.
Really?
And at the same time that our obesity and overweight and you know they're affecting our kids. So, excuse me.
Yeah, it doesn't
seem. So that's huge.
Yeah.
And now if we can get the nutrition and the health community to weigh in, I mean another real irony of it all is the Farm Bill costs $90 billion. Now the Center for Disease Control estimates that the obesity crisis could cost anywhere between $125 and $200 billion.
Really?
And that's lost work, that's medication,
mm-hmm.
all kinds of direct costs related to, you know, heart disease and these other things. So, you know, as you start to peel these things back, I mean, it's a real crazy system. We spend all this money, we subsidize a completely wrong kind of agriculture, and then we have conservation programs to kind of put a Band-Aid on what we're doing to the land. We're paying this huge price, you know, nutritionally. Those impacts go on and on and on. And I think over and over, as I'm looking at the data and I'm looking at the studies, if you do the right thing, it's such a good move economically, mm-hmm. short-term and long-term, health,
yes.
ecologically, environmentally. You know, it's really going toward a better system is just real sound fiscal policy. So I could be optimistic, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think anything could be better than what we have, but I think that there are the seeds for something way better than
maybe
what we have.
Maybe some good things are converging
yeah.
right now.
Yeah.
I don't usually do this on Mouthful, but I'm going to invite you. If anyone has a question about the Farm Bill, you can just call directly into the studio. 588-0637 is the number. That's 707-588-0637. Of course, if you're listening to this as a podcast, we're not here right now.
Yeah.
We don't know when you're listening. But, if you have a question about the Farm Bill, anything to do with the Farm Bill, just give us a call here in the studio. What do you think? I know that there's a number of events going on. So one of the things, I'm going to answer my own question even before I ask it.
That's
one of the things to do is to get educated.
Yeah.
And the book really does lay things out quite well, Food Fight, the Citizen's Guide to a Food and Farm Bill. By Daniel Imhoff. Take a look at it. It's by Watershed Media out of Healdsburg. That is your little company.
Yep.
And
it's a 501c3.
Oh,
that's nice. And we are distributed by UC Press, so the book's available in any store.
Mm-hmm. And can people buy it on your website?
Yeah, they absolutely can. Watershedmedia.org, if we're allowed to say that.
Yes, you are. Watershedmedia.org to take a look at the book or order the book if you would like. So once people get themselves educated, and I know that there are events that will help facilitate that, you and Michael Pollan are going to be down in Berkeley on March 21st. You'll be up in Santa Rosa at the Jackson Theater at Sonoma Country Day School on April 4th. And these are teach-ins, is that right? More
yeah.
or less?
Yeah. The Pollan event is bringing in people from five different people from around the country, so they have their particular expertise. And, you know, he's a really fun person to listen to moderate and participate in a discussion. So I'm pretty excited about that and the numbers of people that he might be able to bring. And then the Sonoma Country Day school event on April 4th, they're both Wednesdays, is going to be a conversation between I and a chef from back east named Dan Barber, who's written some really, really great, totally popularizing pieces around the Farm Bill, and he's also a chef and an activist. So that will also have a teach-in component. And in both of these events, what we're hoping to have people leave with is some language that they can craft letters, and maybe even their kids can craft letters, mm-hmm. and let all of our representatives put them on notice that this is an important bill to us. We're not just going to let you pull it over like you did the energy and the transportation bill and so many other bills. We're going to be educated, and we're going to, you know, have an opinion.
Mm-hmm. And you just mentioned kids. I have to confess, I haven't had a chance to see. Is there anything that focuses directly on kids in the book about how to get kids involved? Or is that something
I wouldn't say necessarily that it directly deals with kids, but kids' nutrition and school uh-huh. lunches are just
a huge thing.
It's a huge wedge. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing here in this county, and especially down in Berkeley, but in cities all over the country, you're seeing school districts take control of their food system, and maybe they're banning soda and high fructose
right.
corn syrup or trans fats or something like that, but there's a movement towards meals made from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes meals made from scratch from the garden or whatever, and you know, they're saying, look, we want you to break down some of these barriers that you put on us as school systems. We want either more money, we want more programs to get fresh vegetables into our schools. And I mean, I have a buddy who runs a number of school lunch programs down in San Francisco, and I've read lots of studies, and it's so, the proof is in the produce, basically. You know, when you give the kids a salad bar, when you start to feed them from scratch, it changes their whole day.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Absolutely.
And so this is something that I would like to see, and many others, not just me, on par with the physical fitness programs of the 60s when I grew up.
President,
you know,
Kennedy started.
Yeah.
Those were huge. I still have my certificate somewhere.
And this could be a world-changing thing.
Wow,
school lunch is actually so crucial to a good start and a healthy economy. And, you know, the land body is completely mirrored. You know, we have healthy land or we don't have healthy bodies, I'm pretty sure.
Okay, I think if technology is on our side, we have a caller. Hi there, you're on Mouthful.
Yes.
You have a question about the Farm Bill?
Yes. I had a farmer friend up in Rice Country, and one time the Farm Bill limited each farmer to only $50,000, so he just divided the farm up to his wife and himself and the two children, and they got their $200,000 like always. And this put me to thinking, would our nation be better off if we just did away with the whole Department of Agriculture and took the nutrition section, the food stamps, and the school lunch program and put it over in Health and Human Services? Would our nation be better if we just quit this whole welfare for farmers?
Danielle, you want to?
Well, are you still on the line?
Yes.
What do you think?
As a consumer, I think we'd be a lot better off.
Well, there is a model of this in the mid-80s. New Zealand pretty much scrapped most of its subsidy program, and it was mainly brought about by the farmers. They were having a fiscal crisis, and they just said, look, the subsidies that you're throwing at us, they're not really benefiting us. They just mm-hmm. Quickly go right from the farmer to the next level of people who are buying the subsidies. So, you know, there's a model for it. You can't even say it's an experiment because it's over 20 years old, and New Zealand has a very aggressive and a successful global agricultural economy. I could go back and forth on any given day because I do believe that you know, monies that are put out by the government, they do have a multiplier effect. I think in the early days of the Farm Bill, I read that there was supposedly a 7 times multiplier effect. So it does have this ripple effect in our economy, but there is such bad enforcement, like you're saying, such incredible loopholes, and I think we at a very minimum need to step back and assess what we're doing almost on a yearly basis and ask some basic questions. Who's benefiting? Are they working? Are these policy relevant? And we're really at a crucial stage. You know, we're 70 years into it. I would say that the Farm Bill is basically failing its goals, and it's time to either step up or maybe take more drastic measures, like you said.
Thanks for your call. Time flies by with you, Daniel. It just goes really fast. Before we wrap up the show, and I want to give people dates about the events again and how to get to your website. One of the things I love lists. And here you have 25 ideas whose time has come. Let's talk our way through some of these.
Well, I think the first one came to me pretty clearly that, you know, you have the food pyramid. And that's this, you know, diverse set of nutritional guidelines put out by the USDA. Yeah,
which is itself, you know, like...
You can barely read it anymore. It's almost criminal what they did graphically to the food pyramid. But, you know, you're supposed to eat a diversity of different foods and 5 vegetables and fruits a day. And yet that's completely disconnected from the crops that we're subsidizing. Mm-hmm. So if we could more closely align crop supports and have more equity so that the things that the pyramid tells us we're supposed to eat are also nutritionally affordable, then I think that would be a good move. Organic farming and grass farming, I think it's really important
now
to
when
me
you say
as a researcher.
When you say grass farming, explain a little bit about what that means.
Well, it would be kind of the opposite of what we're doing now in most of the Midwest, where we're row cropping feed mm-hmm. for animals that are then fed in confinement. And, mm-hmm. you know, many of us have learned so many of just the horrible things that come from animals being fed in big confinement and the health benefits and the environmental benefits of them back on grass. Pastures.
So you mean grass pastures.
Grass pastures. Mm-hmm. And as we look at a world that's going to be absolutely affected by climate change, that we're going to have very unpredictable storm events. These resilient landscapes, grass is so much more stable and resilient than row crop, just mm-hmm. bare soil. So to me, that's almost a number one priority. The research that's coming out on organic farming, you know, it used to be that they said if we switched to organic, we were going to have to plow up all of our wildlands and we were going to starve and it was going to be impossible to actually, you know, compete with conventional farming. And the exact opposite is really coming true, that small, diverse organic farming operations can actually be as or more productive mm-hmm. than the ones that are based on toxics without those costs, but nutritional values are higher. Biodiversity values are higher. I would like to have organic almost be a benchmark for subsidy programs, at least within a very short period of time, because I think that it just makes all the sense in the world. They, you know, we're heavily subsidizing GMOs right now in our Farm Bill programs, and
that's genetically modified organisms.
And no other country really wants them.
Right.
But there's a huge demand for organics all over the world. So, you know, that makes a lot of sense to me. I'm really concerned about grain ethanol. I think, you know, I talked about how the Farm Bill is a pie, and there's these occasional wedges that get forced into the pie. The ethanol wedge could actually turn out to be extremely negative, and we could put a lot of money into corn and biodiesel, highly, highly destructive crops, for very, very limited benefit on the biofuels perspective. We could trash our farmlands and our water systems in a short amount of time just to keep driving without more national goals for conservation and a carbon tax and things like that that could really change behavior. You know, they're holding out this promise of perennial switchgrass and, you know, let's just use cellulosic ethanol. We just have to get over the technological hump, and then don't worry, we can use our farmland to just keep driving forever.
Getting, you know, 14 miles a gallon.
Yeah, and so if we don't have a much more integrated strategy than that, let's just have our farmers do it. I'm afraid that's a recipe for disaster. Mm-hmm. And I hope that we ask our representatives, let's really have conservation stewardship guidelines for any kind of ethanol expansion. Otherwise, whole states that used to grow cotton right now are considering going to corn. We're going to have corn in Georgia. They're building these plants everywhere. And, you know, it worries me, does concern me. And so conservation has to be the basis in my 25 ideas whose time has come. Conservation really has to be the basis of our subsidy programs, protecting the land for future generations so that they can keep farming too, not just so we can just keep driving.
Are there any signs in Washington that there are people in a position of power who have that point of view?
Yes, and I can tell you that when I first did my interviews, Colin Peterson was referring to this bill as the renewable fuels bill. And he's since had a turnaround, and he's really advocating for these conservation programs within his House Ag Committee bill. So I do see that the word is starting to get out. Like, whoa, we can't just scrap our conservation reserve program and take all of our idled land and put it into corn. And I think another idea is that time has come. Local foods systems, like having these regional food chains, big farmers, small farmers working with schools and hospitals and other institutions. They need these new links. They could seriously benefit from some money to do all kinds of different startup programs.
Yeah, and I can see where if you do take that money from the Farm Bill, you could do a whole system of regional satellites that allowed for production much closer to home, which has not just the implications we've been talking about for an hour, but even security issues.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a term for these, you know, the dangers of big confinement animal feedlot operations, and it's agroterrorism, where there's so much food being produced in one spot. A little bit of contamination could hurt a lot of people.
Yeah. And on that note, you know, another hour has gone by. You got to come back again, Daniel. It's always really informative and really interesting. I appreciate you taking time out to join us. Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to a Food and Farm Bill by Daniel Imhoff with a foreword by Michael Pollan. Check it out at watershedmedia.org or buy it from your local independent bookseller. You know, if you go online, go to Daniel's website. Don't go to one of those big places. There will be the event on March 21st at
Wheeler Auditorium at University of California, Berkeley. Yeah. Tickets are on sale right now through the Zellerbach Auditorium. I think it's free for students and $5.
Oh, so it's really, really accessible. Mm-hmm. Well, you do really great work.
Thank you so much. And Sonoma Country Day.
Oh, that's right.
On April 4th.
April 4th.
And that's going to be with Slow Food, Sonoma County.
And you have a weekly radio show on KZYX up in Mendocino.
I have a monthly radio show.
Okay.
On the third Monday between 1 and 2. You can stream on that or listen on kzyx.org.
Okay, on that note, see you next week here on Mouthful.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes. Support for Mouthful comes from KRCB Radio members and from JAG Public Relations, providing comprehensive marketing for the hospitality industry with an emphasis on wine, food, and beverages. JAG Public Relations will manage your web content and provide your graphic and still photography needs. More information at 707-795-9400 or at jagpublicrelations.com.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.